Okay, let's get started. There's a couple teams that aren't going to be here because they're working on their project last minute. So, Ralph, where do you go? Ralph, I apologize for not having a few more people here, but that's the case. Such is the case. So, we haven't been in the classroom for a while, and we've been on a couple of tours since then. Who went on the tours? Any of the tours? So, do you have any thoughts about, you know, what you saw and questions about what you saw? What was the most interesting thing you saw? What impressed you? Did you see anything neat, cool? Did you like the robot? Yeah. Did you notice, Nicole? Right, the patient.
He talks about how, like, one second everything's fine, and the next it's not.
Right. So the user, the patient at the VA was injured in a surfing accident. He was just in the surf, and he hit a wave wrong, and he hit his head and became paralyzed instantly about 9 months ago. So that happens, yeah, unfortunately. So we also went to the assistive technology lab, and it was sort of cool to see Nicole in a power wheelchair, and I'm glad you guys got to use a bunch of the equipment there and do some hands-on stuff. So that was good. I just wanted to say that the VA is actually a pretty well-funded organization. That just the Palo Alto facility has a budget of an additional budget of $1.6 billion of our taxpayer money going into new construction and people and services. So veterans are taken very good care of. So if there's ever any question about that, that's where the money is going. So it's sort of near the end of the quarter, and I'm sort of looking ahead to next quarter. So if you guys have any ideas, any thoughts about problems that could be addressed by student projects, please let me know, and we'll put it on the sheet for next year. In addition, if you're interested in contributing in a financial kind of way as a project partner via a gift of money, that would be appreciated. I don't automatically get money from Stanford to do this course, so I have to look for funds outside. So please keep that in mind. A few sign-ups here for teams doing their final presentations on Tuesday. There's a time slot sign-up sheet over here. In addition, more importantly, next Thursday is the end of quarter celebration. So anybody can attend that. So make a choice between pizza, burritos, and drinks, and we'll be meeting in here on Thursday at the beginning to do a course evaluation, and then we'll be heading over next door to celebrate. Is that okay? Okay. So for students working on projects, you have to really sort of consider where you are, because there's only 5 days left, and have plans if something doesn't work out the way you planned it to work out. If you can't get a part or something breaks or doesn't work, you know, please keep in mind, you know, what the backup plan is. Everybody's welcome to attend the final presentations on Tuesday, and the celebration next Thursday. Final reports for students working on projects. The individual reports are due on Monday. For students working in teams, they're due a week after that, a week from Monday the 19th. If you don't have a good printer, laser printer, color laser printer to print your report on, I can print it on my printer, and I'll be happy to give you your own personalized copy. So and also send me an email version of your report as well as your presentation. And I'll provide the report covers. So I'll pass those out next on Tuesday. In addition, everybody who's working on a project will do an individual personal reflection, and they're due on the 19th as well. So this is just your personal feelings and impressions, what you thought about, what you felt about taking the course and working on projects. In addition, people who are missing, who have unexcused lectures that they need to make up, please do that. And for students who have incurred expenses doing their projects, I'll send you an email regarding the process to get reimbursed for that. Okay, any questions on this stuff? For people doing presentations, I want to remind them that they should use people-first language in their presentations, on their slides, and in the report. That really stands out to me. It's important to have use this people-first terminology. So you say people with disabilities rather than disabled people. It's very important to rehearse your presentation so that you can time it and know if you're going over. And it's a good idea to rehearse the presentation with somebody who hasn't heard it before. So just don't rehearse it with yourself. Rehearse it in front of other people, and they can give you some feedback on it. In that same vein, regarding your final report, please have somebody proofread it other than your team, just to catch any errors. And I think the way we'll do the final presentations is it'd be great if everybody sent me their slides, and I can put them all up on my laptop so we won't have to fumble changing from one laptop to the next. So in doing so, it'd be a good idea to stick with pretty standard fonts, and to, if you have any videos, to include those as separate files or a link to a YouTube URL. That works the best. And finally, since there'll be people who are maybe looking to hire you in the audience, I would like everybody to dress professionally. And so that's no jeans, flip-flops, T-shirts, shirts hanging out. You know, one time, you know, you can, you know, eventually you're not going to be a student anymore. So maybe this is a good time to practice, you know, not being a student at your final presentation. That's not too hard, I hope. I want to make you aware of a couple student design competitions. Since you're going through the trouble of making a final report, you can probably use that report and enter one of these design competitions. The two that I just came across are the Resna one, and their conference is in Baltimore at the end of June. And one of the teams from a few years ago made it to the finals, and so their whole team got an expense-pay trip to Washington, D.C. to present their stuff. So it's a good opportunity for you to meet other students and to compete on a national level at this and go to the conference. So check that out. There's also this Create the Future contest, and it's not just for students, but it's also for entrepreneurs and engineers. But there is a medical entry category, so your project can fit into one of those categories. And I'll send you links to those websites. So now I want to talk about a few things. This is a sign that one of my colleagues found, and nobody can figure out what it really means. So it's a wheelchair symbol, and underneath it says walk, and underneath that it says only. So if anybody has an idea what this really means, let me know, because we weren't able to figure it out. Okay, well, maybe they just forgot that. you know, there's service animals can include animals other than dogs as guide dogs. One of my colleagues at the VA, who's a quadriplegic, has a service monkey that was provided for him, like this picture. But other animals can serve those with who are disabled. For example, in this picture, you see a squirrel who's disabled and in a tiny wheelchair being pushed by another squirrel. So this happens. But I want to segue into a humor a little bit, and this is John Callahan. He's a quadriplegic who has a really weird sense of humor. He died a couple years ago, but his cartoons are fantastic, and I like to go through a few of those because they are funny. But you know, some of them are a little off color, but you know, he can do it because he's a person with quadriplegia. But able-bodied folks, it would be inappropriate for them to draw these cartoons. So the first cartoon are two elephants in a circus, and one saying to the other, "I'm getting a personal trainer." They're big, fat elephants, so that's funny. So here's a six children around a dinner table, and the mother saying, "Finish your vegetables. There are children in Beverly Hills with eating disorders." Okay. So he drew all this by hand, and he has to sort of hold one hand in order to get enough force and accuracy to make these cartoons. Next cartoon is of a heavyset woman in front of her refrigerator, and on top is a stoplight with the stoplight blinking. So she's waiting for it to go green to attack the refrigerator. Here's a bookstore scene where there's a person buying a book called Putting Out a Fire, and his whole upper half is on fire, and he's saying to the salesman, "I won't be needing a bag." Here's a street scene, a policeman chasing a snowman who has robbed a bank or something, and so the policeman has a drop on the snowman, but instead of saying freeze, he says thaw. There's two men in a restroom in a urinal, and the clown. There's a clown on the right, and he's using the urinal with his spritzing flower on his lapel. So weird. There's two frames here. On the left frame, it shows a person walking down the street talking to himself, and it says "unacceptable raving street nut," and the frame on the right is the same photo, but a guy with a handset in his hand. I guess this was done before the era of cell phones, and it says "acceptable raving street nut." Commentary on use of a cell phone on the street. Here's a bum in a garbage dump saying, "Oh my God, I forgot to get an education." Here's a Jesus figure, and instead of walking on water, he's using a skateboard. This one says, "The Pope digs Madonna. The Pope is wearing two conical hats, not one, but two." Madonna wore a couple of conical clothing apparati in a different area of her body. But so this is a takeoff. There's a guy kneeling at the foot of his bed praying, and he's saying, "Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now?" Another snowman scene, a snowman with a hairdryer in his hand, with a note on the floor, and he's about to turn on the hairdryer pointed at his head. Weird, huh? Here's a guy who's obviously jumped off of a skyscraper with a phone in his hand, and he says, "Hello, suicide hotline. I've changed my mind. A little too late." Here's a blind Santa Claus, and instead of using a long cane, he's using a candy cane to find his way. Here's Superman with his guide dog. So Superman is flying about maybe 6 feet above the ground with his left hand on his trusty guide dog. Here's a graffiti artist, a street scene, and instead of spray painting letters, he's spray painting Braille. Here's a nun in a full habit, and instead of a guide dog, she has a guide penguin. Here's a chorus in a mental ward, the mental Christmas choir, and they're singing, "Do you hear what I hear?" Here's a street scene with a guy with two hooks, and the sign says, "We'll refrain from shaking hands with you for $5. Here's a bar scene, another guy with two hooks, and the bartender says, "Sorry, Mike, you just can't hold your liquor." Okay, this is a bunch of guys doing exercises, but unfortunately they're quadriplegics using a respirator, so all they can do is move their eyes, and the leader is saying, "Okay, let's get those eyeballs moving." This is sort of a la Ed Roberts, if you... That's what it reminded me of. Here's a street scene in an alien world where the aliens have three legs, and there's an alien in a wheelchair who has an amputated right leg begging for money. Here's a guy talking to a fellow in a wheelchair, and he's saying, "Heel." And instead of getting up out of the wheelchair and walking, he's getting up out of the wheelchair and healing by the side of the other man, dog style. Here's a psychiatrist's office, and a psychiatrist says, "You're too screwed up, next patient please," and he's being dumped down the trap door. Here's a party scene in a guy's house, and the host is saying to the guest who's outside in a wheelchair, "Sorry, Bill, we're trying to get a ramp for those stairs before our next dinner party. Need more potatoes." Here's a street scene in a western town, and the sheriff, there's two guys about to draw, and the sheriff is saying to the other guy who is a double arm amputee, "Don't be a fool, Billy." He can't use his guns. Here's two guys who are basically just heads in a street scene. One guy has an eye patch, and the guy without the eye patch is saying to the other guy, "People like you are a real inspiration to me." That's pretty sick. You should have seen the ones I deleted. So here's two cowboys in wheelchairs, and the cowboy got the drop on the other one, and he says, "This town ain't accessible enough for the both of us." And my all-time favorite is a posse of three guys on horseback in looking for the outlaw in a desert scene, and they come across a lone wheelchair, and the sheriff says, "Don't worry, he won't get far on foot." But, you know, you have to have seen the movie where they said that when they found the stranded horse. I mean, that's what, if you, yeah. So, today we're honored to have Ralph Hotchkiss. And Ralph is an inventor and lead designer of the Whirlwind Wheelchair Company. And his project, Whirlwind Wheelchair International, is from San Francisco State University, where Ralph teaches a class, Wheelchair Design and Construction, where students build a complete wheelchair in a third world appropriate shop. The company's mission is to make it possible for every person in a developing country who needs a wheelchair to obtain one that will lead to optimum personal independence and integration into society. Ralph is a graduate of Oberlin College and is a 1989 MacArthur Foundation Fellow, and he's AutoCAD user number one. So let's welcome Ralph to Stanford again. Come on down and I'll mic you up, or I can mic you up from... slides.
Yeah, I see the ramp entry. Standard is changing. I can't find a place to demonstrate my chair because there's no rough terrain around here enough. Standard has been one of the slower universities to become accessible. Is this thing working? I guess it is. Yep.
I'll put your slides up.
Okay. So I'm writing the newest model of Whirlwind. Our project has gone on for 32 years now. And most of that time we've been at San Francisco State University. And we've been basically trying to work with wheelchair riders in developing countries who already were building their own wheelchairs. They have been among the most active inventors of wheelchairs in the world. And I've been lucky enough through the disability rights movement, Grapevine, to make contact with dozens of people with significant disabilities all over the world, most of them wheelchair riders, and all of them with something to say about wheelchair design. Partly because they've gotten the worst of the worst overall. Most people in developing countries who need a wheelchair don't have one. 25 million easily today need chairs, don't have them yet. And almost as bad as that is that those few that have them, probably less than a million out of the many that need them, typically have secondhand chairs from the North. They have thrown away chairs from the U.S. or Europe. It's funny, in the U.S., if your wheelchair wears out, if you, say, break your leg and receive a chair or buy a chair for temporary use, you can, once you're done with it, or once it breaks down and you buy another, you have a choice of either paying the garbage man, say, 10 or 20 bucks to haul it away, a little extra tip, or donating and taking a, say, $300 to $500 or even $1,000 tax deduction. And that's where most of the chairs in the third world have come from, U.S. and Europe, some from Japan. And most of them were broken when they arrived, and once they get fixed, if they get fixed, the users are lucky to get another few months out of those chairs, because those are typically hospital-style chairs, designs from the States and Europe of, say, 50, 60, 70 years ago, still being made today, but old designs far outmoded, and just not well engineered. My first wheelchair was in 1966. I slipped on sand on the road on a motorcycle, broke my back, and they gave me a wheelchair. I escaped from the hospital with it, headed down the street in Chicago. Half a block down the street, hit a crack in the sidewalk, only about 4 centimeters high, and stopped me cold. Almost threw me out of the chair, because this chair had a very short wheelbase, a 15-inch long, what is that in metric, 375 millimeters, 37 centimeter track length, and a 26-inch high center of gravity. What would that be, 24? 650 millimeters high center of gravity. And That's the same as a Toyota that's three stories tall. If you take the length of the Toyota and its current height of center of gravity, adjust it to be that same ratio as a standard wheelchair, it's three stories high. You touch the brakes on that car and it falls on its face. Well, that's what this chair did. Luckily, I didn't quite fall out. Because my legs are long, my footrests were low, they hit the ground, and that just barely kept me from tipping forward, and I managed to hook my arm over the back, and so I didn't fall out either. But then I tried to keep going, and the chair wouldn't move. I looked down, and there was one of my front forks bent back, and the front wheel was rubbing on the frame. It was just jammed. There was no way to get it to move in the forward direction. And so eventually somebody came along, and they dragged me backwards back to the hospital, and when I could, I showed the chair to the manufacturer, and they said, "Oh, well, that's no problem. Sorry, it cost you $2,000 in today's money, but we'll give you another one just like it." And that one, of course, lasted well longer than a half a block because I was very careful. But I had been a bicycle rider all my life, and I was not used to having to carry the bicycle over railroad tracks. I mean, I just rode that thing, and it lasted because the bicycles of designs of the 1890s were way far advanced, better than the wheelchairs of 1960, and of the cheaper wheelchairs of today, of the standard hospital-style wheelchairs. So give one of those chairs to somebody in Nicaragua, Kenya, Uganda, India, Sri Lanka, Philippines. If they hit the road, if they need to go, say, 5 kilometers to school, to work, if they're carrying kids on their chair besides, doing what people normally do, that chair is not going to last. And all over the world, as of 1980, when my project started, there were people who had received chairs like this, and as those chairs broke down, they had re-engineered the chairs. They had figured out exactly why the chairs were failing. And re-welded them, reinforced them, remodeled them, lowered them so they weren't so unstable, widened them a bit so they wouldn't tip sideways. And they were way ahead of the whole U.S. industry, which I had been trying to work with since 66 myself, just to make my own chair better, and had very, very little success. There was very little happening in the industry, partly because it was monopoly controlled for 30 years. That's another story. That monopoly has been busted, and things are moving now, but not quite in the direction of what most of the world needs, only what the rich folk here can take advantage of. A good chair in the States now costs $2,000 to $4,000 or more for a manual chair like mine. This one sells for $150 to $300 in now several dozen developing countries. And that's what it should cost. A bicycle still costs, say, $50 in India, less in China. For a good bicycle that you can maintain for a lifetime, a very well-engineered bicycle. Quality control high enough, precision excellent, great bicycles. So, and the wheelchair riders were trying to do the same with their chairs. So we started in 1980 and we began searching out other people. The first group I started working with was in Nicaragua. Let's see, where is it? Oh yeah, there's Nicaragua. This woman is one of a group of four who started the first Nicaragua wheelchair shop in 1980. And here she is this year, testing out our latest model in her neighborhood. Notice that that street has a curb on the other side. They made it inaccessible, but they're a long way from paving it or putting a sewer system under it. So she's still got a rough ride, and now she's just barricaded from visiting her neighbors. She can't go over the curb to visit her neighbors. So we were going down the street testing it out. That's her grandson. It's been a while since she first started building wheelchairs. 32 years, and when she and three others started this little shop, they, of course, some of them were sharing one chair. She had her own chair, but it was broken all the time. It had been broken since before she got it, and she was just fixing it enough to keep it running. She had been to seamstress school. She had worked in a sweatshop making clothes to export to the United States and doing it very, very well and very, very fast. So she taught us how to do all the upholstery sewing and the cushion making, all the other things that need to be sewn on a chair. And some of the others taught her how to weld, how to cut, how to measure angles, how to be more precise than you would ever be necessarily in making clothing, necessary if you're making mechanical things out of steel tubing. Steel tubing was available in Nicaragua because the bicycle industry and the restaurant chair industry, really. A local fellow had imported equipment to turn imported sheet metal into tube. So they got going. But we had a lot of problems to solve. How to make the front wheels in particular. How do we make a front wheel in Nicaragua out of all locally available material, and make it so that it won't wear out? Front wheels still are one of the most quickly breaking down parts of modern wheelchairs. The bearings are way substandard. They're the same bearing you use in a skateboard. A little bitty bearing. Costs about 50 cents in quantity. For 75 cents, you can get a hell of a bearing twice as big and much, much, much stronger with about 8 times the strength rating. But that's not what the wheelchair industry chooses to do. They'd rather save 25 cents. And so, how to do the best that the bicycle... Well, basically, how we were trying to figure out how to copy the best of what the bicycle industry had done in the previous 100 years and apply it to wheelchairs. Bring the wheelchair up to the date, up to the state of the art of the bicycle of 1900. And we needed help. So we started looking around the world. The Disability Civil Rights Grapevine is very, very active and international as far back as 1980 and further. There were organizations of people with disabilities in virtually every country. And they were working more or less independently, but the word was getting around and people were getting together and trading ideas, working primarily to get health care, to get kids into schools, to get access to jobs, and to be able to use public transportation. And as all of you know, that fight is far, far from over. There's a lot left to do, but there's some progress. And countries like the U.S. Have set good examples for physical access, things like that ramp in the corner, not necessarily the entrance to the building, a little complicated. You have a choice of 3 steps or a way, way over standard steepness ramp to get here. But we haven't set a very good example with our public transportation because we've done it a pretty expensive way. There are really cheap ways to make, for example, city buses accessible. Instead of having a ramp to lower down to the street, all you have to do is get a bunch of dirt and concrete and raise the loading area up to the bus level and put a ramp on that, maybe even a rain roof over it. And countries like Brazil set much, much better examples than we did as long as 30, 40 years ago. Curitiba, Brazil has a very, very good bus system with circular buses at different radii from the center of the city, plus radial buses going out in every direction. You can get on a bus anywhere in Curitiba, and within 15 minutes, you're pretty much anywhere else. And every one of the stops on that system is raised. They didn't do it primarily for wheelchair riders. They did it primarily to make an efficient bus system. Because if they have a raised bus system, you don't have to wait for people to climb the stairs, and some people are slower than others. You don't have to wait for each person to enter individually. Their buses have a whole wall that opens, and people just pour on and pour off. Then once you're in, you can pay your fare as the bus takes off. Very, very efficient. Go visit Curitiba, southern Brazil. Very interesting how they've done that. And better example than anybody else, but some others are fighting to take up with that. So we were trying to find other people who could help, and we one of the places that we found out about was Kenya. The woman in the middle was running a little electronics repair shop. Size of about 2 telephone booths, and she and 2 other fellows were working there, doing fairly high tech, very high tech, TV and radio repair. They had been trained by a fellow who had visited from Japan, and he was good. He was so sharp. I met him. All around the top of their walls, they had troubleshooting guides. Lists of how to do all the repairs. I had done TV radio repair before to work my way through college. I was really impressed. They knew what they were doing. And the first thing they asked me, they looked at my chair, they said, "Did you make that?" I said, "Well, sure, how else could it be so ugly?" It wasn't even painted, the one I was riding. It was just a prototype from Nicaragua. I was trying to break it, basically. So I could find out as soon as possible where the weak spots were. And And she said immediately, I want to make 1,000 of those. And I didn't doubt that she could do it. She now has done it several times over. And because her group, her little shop, was part of a much larger group of basically advocates and activists in the disability rights movement in Kenya, a big part of their wheelchair making was not just making wheelchairs to sell. It was working right with the people who got the wheelchairs or who needed the wheelchairs to make sure they could just do the basics of life. Go to school, go to work, raise their families, get around. And this fellow at the front on the left, here he is 15 years old. He had broken his back when he was 7, hadn't been allowed in school since then, because so said his principal, well, we're not accessible, and so he's not allowed. And his mother had been determined. She had gone back every single semester for 8 years and met with the same principal and given him the same bit of hell that whatever she could. And he had always said, oh, well, we'll come back next time. We'll see what we can do. And all they needed were little ramps. They had just 2 steps into their classrooms. And but Kenya has no precedent. When I was a kid, that was true here in the United States, in virtually every school. And it's still true in a whole lot of our schools, that instead of accepting all the kids with disabilities, they will segregate us into levels of disability, take some and push the others far away into special schools, into special programs, into segregated systems. And of course, we all know segregated is never equal. And those kids have very little opportunity later in life, partly because they've missed most of their education. So here we were, up in Meru, central Kenya, heading for the school, which is around the corner and around the field, beyond those houses. And Panina, the woman who was building the chairs, well, first he had just finished building, the kid had just built his own, excuse me, this is, these stories are hard to tell, because I know the people so well, and because the Raphael, the young kid in particular, has lived through so much sheer hell, and is still struggling very hard. So we were headed for the school, and Panina had an appointment to meet with the principal. And she brought me along to slip her technical details about the Americans with Disabilities Act. She went to the principal and claimed that the ADA had been passed in Kenya. This is about 8 years ago. No, 12 years ago now, 12 years ago. And Kenya now has some pretty reasonable laws, and we'll have more soon. But at this time, they had little. But the principal believed her, and she would consult with me for details, and I would give her the letter of the U.S. law, and she would then quote that and say, and this. Luckily, the principal didn't speak English. And he knuckled right under. And they went out back, and they found an old door, and they laid it against their 2 steps, and in went the kid. And, yeah, and we raised the $50 per semester that you have to pay to go to public school there. And that's a lot of money, really, if you're living on a couple hundred dollars a person per year, which is about what the average in their town was, especially their part of the town. And most of the world, food costs the same as here. It's just that they don't eat it the same way we do. But if you go down to the feed store and buy corn, beans, wheat, sort the twigs out of it, clean it, shell it, grind it, you have what the Kenyans survive on. Cornmeal mush, and rice on a weekend, chicken on a weekend, lots of cornmeal mush and some beans and so forth, and plenty of vegetables. Some of you are probably living that way now if you live like I did when I was a student. Here's one of the fellows in the Philippines. The first group we met was in 1981 in Rizal Province, Cainta, Philippines. It was a group of 20 wheelchair riders who had been building wheelchairs at that time for 5 years. And they had a whole series of wheelchair models, including a sports chair that was very good. It was hot. It was a basketball chair. And would have worked fine for tennis and a few other things, too. And they had done it all themselves, really. They had started with these imported chairs, and they had added on every reinforcement that one of them had discovered, or one of their favorite blacksmiths or bike mechanics had discovered with them. They put those all on a regular chair, and at the same time, they made it weigh less. They made it tough as nails and lighter weight all at the same time. And they were selling chairs for $150 and making a living for every one of them. Out back at the factory, the families had little houses all ramped, baby sleeping in the hammock over the bed and a couple more underneath, and room for me on the couch. Really great group of people. And they've now spun off a couple of other shops. Here's a fellow in the shop in Mindanao, a southern island in the Philippines. And, oh boy, are they ever inventors. They just go for it. Here's an example of what happens with our technology, with the older U.S. technology, and which has been the major impact, really, of U.S. technology in the third world until fairly recently. Here's a standard chair from patented in 1926 in the U.S. It has a double flat steel bar X-brace underneath it. And the same short wheelbase, had commercial caster forks and pivots, basically made for pianos and heavy furniture on the front. And it was made in one size, and that size, of course, in order to fit everybody, was extra wide. And she basically never brought it in the house because there wasn't room for it. It was such a big, I mean, it was 1.5 times as wide as she was. The seat width inside the chair. A chair should be fit like a good pair of gloves. Should be custom made, if not at least chosen from a wide variety of sizes, heights, everything you need. Let's see, did I just turn this thing off? Oh, okay, there it goes. Yep. So all the time the Nicaraguans were gathering up ideas from themselves and from Indians, Filipinos, people in Guatemala, Honduras, Brazil, up and down East Africa, and South Africa. Happy that they were able to steal these good ideas and make their own chairs better. I was happy too. My chair was definitely better for me. And one of the things we discovered, look at this fellow's front wheel. This again is a fairly recent one, recent wheelchair. He's put on a much smaller front wheel, but at the same time much wider. Somebody wrote a book about automobile design in 1898 trying to persuade the industry to get away from big wagon wheels like motorcycle wheels, spoked wheels, narrow ones, and go to much smaller but much wider wheels like we have today. And they gave a firm formula saying that every time you widen it by so much, you can shrink it by so much, and you'll go with the same average smoothness or roughness over the same terrain. Of course, there are exceptions in both directions, but pretty much if you make a wheel wider, and soft especially, it will do very well where before you needed a much bigger wheel. So this one is half the diameter of a standard 8-inch wheelchair wheel from 1930s, 40s. But it is three times as wide and rolls very well. Where did we find this wheel? This wheel has an ingenious indentation in the side, whereas we make wheels that are semi-pneumatic, like our wagon wheels. Go to Sears, buy a toy wagon wheel. It's sort of like a bicycle tire with no inner tube, but it's got thick, heavy rubber, stiff rubber, so that it'll carry some load. But that's really hard to mold, that kind of wheel, that kind of tire. You need a multi-piece mold, fairly complex and very expensive to make. The inventor of this had come up with a way of indenting the side instead of hollowing out the middle, and doing it with a simple sandwich mold, just a two-piece mold. You put it in, you take raw rubber, which is sort of like chewing gum, you pack it in the mold, you put it in a two-piece, you know, put the two pieces of the mold together, having weighed rubber first so you have just the right amount, won't have any cavitation, won't have any extra rubber oozing out of the mold getting lost, being wasted, and you cook it for 15, 20 minutes. And it's vulcanizing rubber is like cooking the white of an egg. You're just changing it by heat. And it's permanent. Once it's set, you can't undo a cooked white of an egg, nor can you undo vulcanized rubber. This is only a centimeter thick at the middle, so it's kind of soft. But it's 3 inches wide at the outside, more than 3 inches wide, 80 millimeters wide, and works very well. I saw this in 1988 in the marketplace in Harare, Zimbabwe, in a large 14-inch size, on a cart pushed by a couple of 12-year-old kids, 10-year-old kids, with hundreds of pounds of vegetables going to market over a rocky pathway. And as I watched them, I could see this tire just flexing as it rolled. Bingo, I knew that of the dozens of kinds of front wheels we had tried, nothing held a candle to this invention. And so we put it on the chairs. It worked just great. We named it the Zimbabwe wheel. We never could find the inventor. I hope to someday at least find out who it was. It was invented probably 30 or 40 years ago, in order to replace imported pneumatics in Zimbabwe, and it spread around southern Africa. Great way to make the wheel. And in the middle of this is nothing but a plain old bicycle hub, the front hub from a bicycle. It costs under a dollar anywhere in the developing world. That's even the retail price, typically less than a buck. For the front hub of a bicycle with bearings and with axle, just what we need. So I'll pass this around. You can take a look at it. That hub is molded in. I actually like to make them just with a hole in the middle. That way the shop doesn't have to buy the hubs from the bicycle store, take them to the rubber molder, wait a while, then get it all back. They don't need near as much working capital if they just mold the wheel with a hole in the middle and then press in the hub. And also the hub rolls faster. Can you guess why? Are you into rubber engineering at all? Super balls bounce like crazy because the rubber in them is all pre-stretched. There's a whole lot of built-up tension in that rubber. If you throw them hard enough, they explode into thousands of pieces. And if we mold a smallish hole in the middle of the wheel, then shove the bicycle hub in there using some kind of like a big ball bearing to guide it and stretch the hole to allow us to get in, lubricate it as we go. When we're done, the whole wheel is a little bit stretched. It bounces higher, it rolls further in a coast test. Please, if you have questions, just ask. This is, how's our timing? Good. Okay. Okay. Well, I was staying up here because I didn't see a place to test the chair down there. But here, let me show you this wide front wheel. I'm not going to go all the way to the bottom because I don't think I'll... David, could you catch? Could you measure the narrowest spot there, see if I'll go through or not? On the other side, it looks a little wider. Oh, not a chance. Yeah. Yeah. And 24. Okay. I don't think I'll make it. Not with my wide mountain bike tire. No. Oh well. Yeah, I'll go. But I wanted to show what this Zimbabwe wheel brought us in wheelchair design. The biggest cause of injury to wheelchair riders in the world today is falling out forward, because we have such a short wheelbase and high center of gravity. You hit a crack in the sidewalk, you hit a door threshold. If you're not watching, the chair will stop, tip forward, the footrest will jam in the ground, and out you go. Every day there are people in hospital emergency rooms that fell out of their wheelchairs, on the average, every day. And so, with the ability to make the wheel that small and still get away with it being that small, because of the width, because of the ingenious design that we had found, we could put it under the footrests without raising our knees. So my knees will still fit under the same table that they would in a standard old-style wheelchair. I can't have my footrest too close to the ground because they'll scrape and throw me out a lot. So if I give them a couple, 3 inches of clearance, that's the same as this. My heels only have a couple... 2.5 inches of clearance, I think. My knees are just as low as they are in a standard chair, yet my front wheel can be way out under my toes. And that means that my track length is just long enough so that this chair does... If I'm rolling on... I mean, I'm not talking about going over a cliff, but if I'm rolling on rough terrain and I hit something that stops me cold, I do not have enough energy to lift myself up and over the front wheels at the speeds I go, probably no more than typically 7-8 miles an hour, unless the hill is nice and steep. But at those speeds, there's not enough energy to tip it over. Can you give me a push back up after I come down? Not enough runway to get up this curb. So here I go down this curb. Now I'm a high-level paraplegic, so I fall forward easily. But my seat is tipped back an extra 12 degrees, like your seats, pretty much. Yours look like maybe they're 10 degrees, mine is 12. So here it goes down. My front wheels are on that lower level now. It's not going to dump me. I can drive down as comfortably as I would if I was driving a Jeep. And... easing down the rest of the way. No problem. Okay, now, the next question is, can I turn around? We might have to go up backwards. Anyway, so I do that every day, especially when I'm out and about and away from heavily accessibilized environments. Let's see. Now, it looked like I had plenty of turnaround space, but I don't think there is. No, we have to go backwards. Thank you. So what goes forward down can go backwards up. I apologize for the skid marks. So we have helped several dozen groups start up, but things have changed. In the first 20 years of our project, there was almost no money to help people buy these wheelchairs. And so our groups could make chairs, sell them for, say, $150, $200, depending on the country. And unfortunately, only those who could pay for them could get them. And that was typically people from families who could get together the money. Now, in Zimbabwe, for example, where there's a shop making whirlwinds, they would organize big harambees where the whole family would get together for a holiday, for some other holiday, or for a wedding, or for whatever. And the wheelchair factory would send somebody with the potential wheelchair rider to make a speech. And they would basically say, listen, if you can each chip in, if 40 of you can chip in $5 apiece, your nephew, your cousin can go to school, can get a job, can live, because we have this new opportunity of a Zimbabwe wheelchair ready to go. And almost every time it worked, almost every time. And when they could just get together, say, $80 instead of $160, which was the price there, then that would just make it take a little longer. We would look for other sources. The group there would look for other sources and almost always find it. But it was slow. It was very slow. And about year 2000, some Western philanthropists saw the opportunity, saw the need, and jumped in and bought lots of customary wheelchairs to distribute in developing countries. We couldn't really compete because those customary wheelchairs sold for $40 in China. And there was no country in the world where we could buy the materials that cheaply. A combination of horizontal and vertical monopolization really does work if you want to keep the prices of some things very, very low. And so all of our little shops could not compete. And we've been trying to evolve into the new global economy. Now we're working with six of our more successful and thus larger manufacturers to actually make chairs in large enough quantity to sell to those international donors. And last year, the ones that we've designated as having the quality control necessary for export. It's a little different if somebody's making you a chair and you can come back anytime and get repairs than if you receive a chair from another country and you have no idea who bought it or who made it. It's got to be very, very good. And so we've tightened up the quality control at these shops, helped them tighten up, and they're doing okay. Basically building this model, same one I'm riding. Mine was made in Indonesia. But of course the first Indonesian one was made in Nicaragua. And then they brought it there and they used it as a sample. So they're beginning to work their way into this new big international market. And here are some of the characteristics of wheelchairs that make them more complicated than, for example, bicycles. We need to fit so many different kinds of people with so many different types of disabilities, living in so many different environments, whole different levels of access or not, that all of these things can be accommodated, things like different ages, different abilities, different disabilities. At the same time, we can take advantage of the fact that that the people riding these chairs have lots going for them. A large percentage of the people that our chairs have gone to are multilingual, for example. They'll know a local language, a national language, and often an international language as well. They have great attitudes about disability. They're ready to fight. They understand what's happening all around the world in the disability rights movement, and so they won't take what the principal said in Meru, Kenya, and they won't take that easily. They can both get their chairs repaired by local mechanics instructing the mechanic how to do it and come up with a steady stream of new ideas, improving the chairs. This is our biggest challenge, though. These little shops, small, medium shops, have to make chairs in lots of 300 to 600 to put in one container. One container will hold the unassembled parts of 600 wheelchairs. And most of these shops never made more than 300 a year before, like one chair a day. One chair per working day. So here, the green ones are where our regional manufacturers are at the moment, ranging from South Africa to Georgia, up by the Caspian Sea. Mexico, closest one here. The yellow one in Dominican Republic is our distribution center. It's a rehab center, part of a very, very active disability rights movement in Dominican Republic, where the chairs are assembled, are modified to meet special disability needs for particular disabilities that are rare, and sent on. Several other shops are working toward a distribution center. Eventually, we hope to have far more distribution centers growing out of our old small-scale manufacturers that have been pretty much pushed out of business by the lowering prices from China. There's definitely a place for them. They'll now be getting parts from any of these bigger shops. The custom work for special disability types, they'll be doing the repair work. There's more than enough for them to do. All we do is figure out how to make a living while doing it. If these distribution centers and these regional manufacturers succeed, they'll sell their chairs. They can work with the disability organizations to create serious social change. And think about it. The integration of people with disabilities is one of the strongest aspects of the human rights revolution in the world today. The organizations of people with disabilities include people of every social class, every ethnic group, every regional dialect within, for example, India. The disability groups are all powerful in many, many ways. The disability group in South Africa, the disability group in Uganda, very, very active in their local revolutions. And in both cases, they've written very, very strong law that's way, way beyond what our ADA has provided here, far more advanced, guaranteeing, for example, that people with disabilities be represented in every level of government by people with disabilities. In Uganda, that means some 50,000 people theoretically can be elected to office when you go all the way down to the township level. And not only is it people with disabilities, but because some of the strongest advocates, including a cabinet member today in Uganda, are disabled women, they knew that disabled men could not adequately represent them. So at every level of government, there's not only disabled people, but a disabled man and a disabled woman who are recognized by their local disability organizations as capable of representing them, not just at being a legislature with a closet disability, but representing people with disabilities in their region. And that's happening all over the world. I hope it gets back here sometime. Yeah, here's some examples of what's happening. This is Cali, Colombia, where they're making Hurwinds. And they're fighting to bring Cali up to where Curitiba, Brazil is in access to transit. They have almost nothing now. There's no way they can get around across town except riding their Hurwinds. They're pretty good for crossing, except the hilly parts of town. It gets really hard. Novosibirsk, Russia. There they are, getting into their subway. I rode that subway 22 years ago when we first started in Siberia, before their empire fell apart. And see those grooves on the left side of those stairs? The the guys at the subway said, "Oh, that's what those grooves are for. Here, let's move them a little closer together, and you can come right down those." It was a wild ride, let me tell you. I wouldn't recommend it to anybody. Those are earlier whirlwinds. The one on the right is one on the left is a Russian standard wheelchair. The two on the right are both earlier model whirlwinds. Before we had the Zimbabwe wheel, and here we are, just a few days ago, in Bogota, South America, in La Paz, Bogota, where disabled people were fighting for health coverage, a basic allowance for very basic extra costs of living that result from a disability. I mean, they were only looking for a few dollars, like a dollar a day, a little more than a dollar a day. And luckily they have plenty of whirlwinds there, so when they get in fights with the riot police, their chairs don't break down. And they won. They reached a settlement with the government, and they got enough to make a huge difference in how many of them will, for example, go to school. And probably some very good legislation will result directly from this week of demonstrations. Just an example of how minds change. 20 years ago, nobody really knew much at all about recycling except for a few organizations of environmentalists. And now everybody's knows about it, and most of us are doing it. That's a really major change, and disability rights can go the same way, have gone the same way. Getting people in jobs, communicating with their whole society. This is Uganda. And have they ever, not only do they have the best disability law in the world, South Africa is very similar now, copying theirs, but they haven't carried that out as much as Uganda has left yet. But they also have this amazing group of women building wheelchairs. And they just kick ass. When they knew that we had wheelchair technology available in Kenya, they gave me no choice but to find a way to get it there. And it was expensive, and it took a while. But we were there within a year, somehow. Yeah. And this is another one of those shops where at 5 p.m. A bell rings, and all the kids then are allowed to come in the shop. They're climbing all over their mothers. Haiti, things are starting in Haiti, but boy, it's a hard place for them to live and work. That's it. So any more questions?
So yes. I understand that these wheelchairs are available in these countries for around $300.
Well, not in the U.S. Most countries closer to $200. We're considering them bring them into the U.S. On a buy one give one away plan for a much much higher price of $800 for this pair of chairs, one for a developing country where we use them kind of to prime the pump in different areas, as we have before. So an American should be able to buy one pretty soon for $800. Yes. If you don't need it, they'll help you buy it. If you don't need the money, they'll give it to you. That's how social service works in most of the world. Didn't you know that? If you've got the connections, if you're from the right class, from the right family, from the right neighborhood, you can arrange it. If you're not, adios. But these groups are all fighting to make that make that happen.
Any other questions for Rob? If not, I want to thank you for coming down again. It's always a pleasure to see you. And if you guys got time, come down and meet Ralph and check out his wheelchair. Thanks, Ralph.